Well, this is a Marxist critique of classical feminism. And I think the importance of this topic has increased over the past year or so, because I think the cumulative effect of decades and decades of ramp up of the criminal justice system has finally become obvious. Prison systems in the West are monstrous in size. They are incapable of affording inmates the most basic rights. Prisons are overcrowded. Conditions are increasingly punitive. And to all that, we now have to add COVID-19, which is ripping through prisons in New South Wales and, of course, America at a rapid rate. And in America last year, there was a police killing literally every day of killer cop Derek Chauvin's trial. And the global Black Lives Matter protests, they have shone a bright spotlight onto the reach of police into the lives of the oppressed. Left-wing people are increasingly now calling for prison abolition alongside very popular demands to rapidly scale back the size and power of the police force. And of course, the enormous proportions of the criminal so-called justice system and its cruel treatment is not just an American problem. The Australian Bureau of Statistics National Prison Census shows that as of June 2020, there were 41,060 prisoners in Australia, and that's at a rate of 202 per 100,000 in the imprisonable adult population. And putting this in the long view, it makes it only more telling. So from 1985 to 2018, let me get my slides up. The imprisonment rate actually more than doubled in Australia. And the ABS media release from 2018, you can kind of see that drastic rise in these slides here, which table some of the imprisonment rates. In 2018, the prison population increased by 40% in just 5 years. And in that same year, female prisoner numbers increased by 6%, more than the increase in male prisoners. And the most oppressed in society are really punished the most. In March 2021 quarter of this year, you can see in this graph, 2.37% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were in prison, as opposed to 0.21% of the broader population. You can see the difference in the scale on the y-axis on those graphs. And this massive ramp up, it hasn't occurred out of the blue. One, they have occurred in the context of an increase in income inequality in the Western world and the whittling away of welfare spending. And secondly, they have been connected to campaigns for a tougher approach to what is claimed to be a scourge of interpersonal crime. However, prominent researchers disagree. So, for example, Labor MP Andrew Lee very helpfully wrote a discussion paper last year called The Second Convict Age. And he says in it that the recent increase in the Australian prison population does not seem to be due to crime rates, which have mostly declined over the past generation. Instead, he says, higher reporting rates, stricter policing practices, tougher sentencing laws, and more stringent bail laws appear to be the main drivers of Australia's growing prison population. So to reiterate, the second convict age, as you can see, the imprisonment rates at the moment are almost as actually higher than at points in pre-Federation Australia. Those higher imprisonment rates, they are not driven by higher crime rates at all. And there are a few issues that have been used more consistently and successfully to justify tougher and longer prison sentences than violence against women. So for over 100 years, governments and police have used the issue as the basis for morally charged law and order campaigns. And these have garnered support from political reactionaries and, unfortunately, often progressives. So over the last 10 years or so, we've seen it become a much bigger focal point for establishment feminists, feminist law reformers, feminist NGOs, as well as unions and student unions. There have been so many high-profile campaigns that have been calling for tougher laws and longer sentences in response to instances, often very concrete instances of violence against women. And heaps of government money has gone into public awareness campaigns, government ads, very superficial, in my opinion, education programs, and so on, as well as funding for expanding police and prison systems. These things have gone alongside one another. But meanwhile, vital services like shelters, helplines, dedicated health facilities and welfare provisions, they have been cut back or they remain untouched. The political framework for the progressive support for these campaigns is that women must be protected from men at any cost. And this is sometimes based on the feminist belief that sexual assault and battery are tools used by men to ensure the subordination of women to the male group. Sexual violence towards women is therefore universal. All women are victimised by it and have the potential to be. Redress must therefore involve intervening into this one-sided power struggle between men and women in order to bring men to heel. And the obvious force equipped to intervene into this terrible and ubiquitous struggle is the state. So the policies that have fed the bloated carceral apparatus that I described at the start, they have therefore been campaigned for by a section of progressive opinion. Carceral feminism is the label that is given to this current that has actively sought these policies. It's the label that is, it's not a self-identification, it's a label that's given to it by its critics. And the hope for effect of these campaigns is obviously a reduction in the incidence of sexual violence through deterrence, as though the issue of violence can be solved separately to ending the system that produces sexism and violence in the first place. Instead, these policies have only empowered the most violent and coercive arms of the state over the population as a whole. And worse, a current of feminists have not just been unwitting accomplices of the state, but have actively sought to bolster it, regardless of or openly at the expense of the rights of other sections of society. And so in this talk, I want to illustrate the problems with carceral feminism with regards to some prominent examples of public campaigns and trials where its logic has been in operation. I'll also explain what the real role of the criminal so-called justice system is in capitalist society. And to doing so, hopefully make the case that politics that looks towards it to mete out harsh punishment to individual perpetrators hurts our side in the fight against capitalism and all injustice. I will examine feminism, both historical and some contemporary examples, to understand better what they get wrong about the roots and solutions to women's oppression that leads in the direction of campaigning to empower the capitalist state. And lastly, I'll look at the current critiques of carceral feminism, because there are plenty of these, and hold up Marxism actually as the ultimate guide to politics to fight for both women's liberation and an end to the violent power of the capitalist state. Okay, so let's start with an example that would be known to many, which is the trial of the Central Park Five. I've included this image because I think lots of people would know it from the drama When They See Us on Netflix. So what happened? In 1991, a young white professional woman from Manhattan was brutally assaulted and left for dead in Central Park after jogging through the area. Five Black and Latino mid-teens, they were residents of public housing north of the park, they were picked up by police and subsequently tried and convicted of sexual assault. This is a gang rape trial. It was extremely high profile, and it centred on questions of law and order and race relations that were animating the political life of New York for at least the previous decade. And so the prosecutor, Elizabeth Lederer, she followed carceral feminist logic in her narrative of the trial. In particular, her belief that the law could play a progressive role to protect women meant she was blind to the way that the criminal justice system oppresses other groups. So she said, despite, and I quote, all these voices that were trying to look at the trial in terms of race, I really felt it was about gender. And another component of the trial was that she examined the defendants herself, and that produced the crucial piece of evidence, which were taped confessions that were actually forced out of children after lengthy detentions and interrogations, which almost assumed their guilt. As well, Lederer dehumanized the young boys, imputing to them, during the prosecution, a criminal and monstrous desire. And all of this is even more unjust when you remember that these children were actually acquitted of this charge much later on. And this would be bad enough in a vacuum, but it worked to reinforce a decades-long campaign by the ruling elite of New York to whip up fears of social disorder, justifying introduction of a tougher law and order response. And these ruling class figures included Donald Trump, who took out full-page ads during the trial for the return of the death penalty. So this sort of campaigning was not new. It was not new to the early 90s New York. Bourgeois and middle-class forces have often campaigned for harsh measures against society's criminal element by appealing to the safety of women. And this is always more about scapegoating dangerous groups in order to exert social control than about helping women. These dangerous groups were said to have an insatiable desire to transgress sexual norms, which allowed these campaigners to utilize a sex panic against these groups. And often these dangerous groups are racialized. For example, the Scottsboro Boys, they were black teenagers charged in 1931 with being a threat to the safety of white women. And that was clearly intended by racists as a stand-in for black men as a group. Similarly, the lynch mob that killed the young black Emmett Till in Mississippi in 1955 was incited on the basis of a false rape accusation against Till. And more recently, this narrative was used to reinforce police presence in urban ghettos across America in the 1990s, and racialized gang violence was used to justify more police powers in New South Wales in the 2000s and in Victoria very recently. Therefore, according to feminist critic Kristen Bumiller, feminist campaigns replicated other moral crusades, in her words, that periodically arouse public fear and root out dangerous persons. So by counterposing women's rights to the rights of the most oppressed people in New York, the Central Park Five prosecutor added to the ruling class narrative that social control measures were necessary. The trial and the media coverage used what Bumiller calls expressive justice and Anthony Bottoms calls penal populism. And this is the expression of outrage about sex offences that aims to generate a mob sentiment for revenge and punishment, because something must be done to deal with such heinous crimes is the way the narrative goes. But this dynamic, rather than leading to justice, instead creates a moral hysteria that obscures the key issues involved, such as where does sexism come from in the first place and what is the main role of the repressive state being called upon to provide punishment. This moral hysteria and simplification also diminishes the complexity and humanity of the issues involved. And the broad category of sex offenders accounts for a huge proportion of the US prison population, according to researcher Marie Gottschalk. She says that it's not only drug crime offenders who are responsible for drastic increases in inmate numbers. In Australia, the sex offender category accounts for 14% of the prison population, which is the third highest group. In the carceral feminist imagination, it is positive that these offenders are cast outside of society and punished. But I think we have to uphold that not every offender is irredeemable, because dehumanising offenders does not address the root causes of social phenomena like sexual violence. And in general, a sentiment of revenge results in an avoidance of looking at the social conditions that create interpersonal sexual crimes in the first place. And the only question that comes to matter is whether or not the state is doing something about these reprehensible actions. And in the case of the Central Park Five, the trial and the media spectacle provided, therefore, the political atmosphere for a massive expansion of the carceral state. Now, what did that look like? Just a few years later, in 1994, there was a colossal suite of measures passed as part of Clinton's Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. And part of that was the Violence Against Women Act. And this was one of the crowning legislative achievements of Joe Biden, which shows just how bipartisan the beefing up of the carceral state has been. The suite as a whole included 60 new death penalty offences. It mandated prison construction and police expansion. It made prisons even more punitive by withdrawing funding for education programs and the like, and it created public sex offender registries. In fact, it actually further connected services for women victims of violence to seeking convictions of perpetrators. So the call for something to be done, therefore, does not cut against the direction of power relations in our society. In fact, it reinforces them. And in the Australian example I want to talk about, this plays out even before the case came to trial. So in late 2012, a young ABC journalist, Jill Maher, was abducted and raped on a casual night out on Sydney Road in Brunswick. This crime occasioned public sadness and outrage. However, your average Joe concerned about women's safety was joined by some unlikely figures in this expressive justice, such as Liberal and Lord Mayor at the time, Robert Doyle, as well as Liberal Premier Ted Baillieu and the police themselves. Unlike any other demonstration against injustice, their attitude was to assist and join the mass marches of 30,000 down Sydney Road to reclaim the night. In fact, they came in quickly promising millions more in funding for CCTV surveillance in the area, as well as a greater police presence. And a section of the marchers, politically, they welcomed these promises. Clearly, though, something more was going on here other than a purported concern for women's safety. But other feminists and leftists who were not so pro-police themselves, nevertheless, they could only see a positive in the so-called community coming together to protest violence against women. But the reality was that the motive force of morality, public mobilisation, and the acquiescence of much of the left to all of this was used in the 2 years aftermath to stiffen bail laws, tighten mandatory sentencing, and reduce eligibility for parole. And the result was a 14% increase in Victoria's prison population in just 1 year, 2013 to 2014. And so this is the correct slide that goes with this, I think. So none of these effects are coincidental to the aims of carceral feminism. In fact, they stem from its core demands. The only question that remains is whether the individuals who advocate for the state to play this role regret its effects, wishing for them to be avoided, or they disregard the rights of others. Nevertheless, the results, I think, are the same. Note that this punitive regime doesn't mean that the incidence of sexual violence has actually diminished. It has just meant that overall more people are locked up, including the victims of sexual violence themselves, often under mandatory arrest provisions and the like that see both victim and offender arrested. In Queensland, astonishingly, in a recent conversation article, it said that 50% of Indigenous women murdered in domestic violence cases have been previously named by the state as perpetrators. In Victoria, it has meant that the prison population for Aboriginal women has grown the fastest out of any demographic. So I think this really begs the question, which women matter? Whose lives matter? As many critics of carceral feminism note, the various punitive elements of the state are involved in routine violations of bodily autonomy and outright sexual assault of women and men, for that matter, in the prison system, in police custody, etc. These violations are often brushed under the rug because they occur at the hands of the state and because they happen to the poor and the oppressed and the already criminalised. On the other hand, the Ma case generated a lot of attention and sympathy because she was middle class, respectable, upwardly mobile, and white. And it's much easier for the powers that be to whip up and make use, therefore, of the moral atmosphere in the wake of Jill Ma's murder, precisely because of her respectability. So now I just want to put two images up on the screen. In contrast, only activist campaigning has brought the name Tanya Day to light. Another woman who did nothing more than have some drinks, Tanya Day, died after a spell in police custody after being arrested on a train near Castlemaine. She was Aboriginal. But because she was a victim of the state itself and Aboriginal, left-wing activists have had to say her name over and over and over again to have her case well known. And while the murder of Sarah Everard in the UK in March had many of the hallmarks of the Jill Ma case, she was also a young, white, middle-class professional whose murder garnered widespread public sympathy and outrage. The case was further complicated because her murderer was actually a police constable with the Metropolitan Police. And so calls by Boris Johnson, you know, that well-known pro-women campaigner, to make misogyny a hate crime, and from Labor MPs to have more police crawling through nightclubs and on streets, they really rang hollow in the context of a member of the force having been responsible for Everard's murder. So these cases hopefully illustrate some of the core dynamics of carceral feminism. And as I've alluded to a few times, there is a really long tradition of the liberal women's movement being uncritical of and actively championing the violence of the capitalist state, not just about violence against women, but as Moira talked about earlier today, the suffragettes actually on the whole supported the slaughter of World War I. The inheritors of this tradition today, I think, are the right-wing feminists who understand full well that their politics have nothing to do with systemic change. In the mid-1980s, some feminists built an unholy alliance with law and order advocates and right-wing Christian politicians to campaign for the preservation of women's safety, and they became open advocates for increasing crime control. And these carceral feminists often intersect with the ruling class or at the very least share their core beliefs. Critic Janet Halley calls their ideas governance feminism, which stems from the installation of feminists and feminist ideas in actual legal institutional power. Now, this isn't just a pipe dream of feminists, but the reality of the capitalist state in the 21st century. You only need to look at Hillary Clinton's campaign in the 1990s against so-called super predators, or Kamala Harris's move to jail parents for allowing truancy, and the ways that both these Democrat politicians claim in electoral campaigns to be champions of women. Carceral feminism is often based on an assumption that the state can, with some reforms, be a neutral arbiter on a question of oppression. It takes for granted that the state is unwilling to punish perpetrators, and therefore that the decision to adopt a more punitive stance against men who offend is a purely positive concession to women's struggle. So despite presenting an element of critique of the state as it exists, ultimately the calls for the state to strengthen its hand against perpetrators resolves this critique. As anti-carceral feminist Koshka Duff says in a recent piece in Historical Materialism, the aim of carceral feminists cannot be to undermine the state's power to criminalise, but to wield that power against the perpetrators of sexual violence. Duff also points to a central moral dilemma that's posed by the carceral feminists in response to left-wing critiques opposing criminalisation and the state. She says, it seems we must be either rape apologists or state apologists. So carceral feminism sets up this counterposition between women's rights and opposition to the state, which can be used to browbeat leftists who insist on opposing state repression, quite rightly. Therefore, there is nothing intrinsically left-wing about concern for women divorced from broader questions of social organisation and political power. Women's rights advocates can be for upholding the oppression of others, and feminism can be the way a section of the ruling class brands itself to obtain legitimacy. the right-wing feminists are often silent on questions of sexual violence towards groups that are targeted by the establishment. For example, the almost complete silence from them on the sexual abuse of refugees on Manus Island and Nauru, the fact that they champion imperialist invasions like of Afghanistan, the deafening silence from right-wing feminists, on questions of police and prison officer violence, sexual or otherwise, towards those who find themselves in custody or in prison. I think carceral feminists also make backwards assumptions about women too, because in their conception, women as a group are defined by their vulnerability to male attack and their injured state as a result. Of course, this isn't to deny the incredibly injurious effect of sexual assault. It's a really terrible part of the myriad of interconnected ways women are oppressed and degraded in capitalist society. However, in the carceral feminist vision, women are defined precisely by their powerlessness in a way that demands paternal protection. And there's been an increasing trend since the decline of the radicalism of the late 60s and early 70s towards seeing women solely as victims rather than having some agency within an overall sexist society. Particularly absent is the agency to be part of collective political and social struggles for liberation. And this is really an inherent limitation to the campaigning focus on women's vulnerability to attack in the atomized world of interpersonal relations. That is, it has an inbuilt tendency towards feminism as crime control. Nevertheless, feminism and crime control have a contested relationship. Some feminists, while campaigning for institutional change, were hostile to the state in the 60s and 70s era, characterized by social upheaval and police repression. Instead of relying on the state, they set up their own institutions to raise consciousness and shelter women who were victims of domestic violence and rape. On the other hand, the National Organization of Women in America, which was the most bourgeois wing of second wave feminism in the 60s, they campaigned for law reform around sexual violence and succeeded in changing rape statutes in 1971. And this reflected an awareness of sexual and domestic violence towards women as a systemic problem and reflected a desire to cut against its naturalization. The reforms they sought were, of course, progressive. The legality of rape in marriage, for example, or the admissibility of sexual history as evidence in rape trials are repugnant and driven by sexism. And the fact that in Australia as well, similar laws were taken off the books as a result of advocacy is a progressive development. However, this success had contradictory results. It tended to take the focus of the women's movement campaigning away from larger social change and towards alliance with the legal system and law enforcement. And once established, this became the start of a trend in the women's movement towards not just removing discriminatory statutes, but campaigning for harsher punishment for offenders. And so some feminists pushed back. For example, the New York Radical Feminists, they pushed back in 1974 with a statement that said rape is not a law and order issue. But in the end, they could not hold up to the pressure to intersect with the law and order campaign spearheaded by bourgeois feminists. And in the context of a decline in working class struggle in Australia and Britain, which had brought victories on equal pay and offered a different model for the women's movement tied to fighting the system as a whole, a law and order focus became much more prominent. And even for those who held out in all three countries, the capitulation was bound up with the desire to fund the services they set up. State funding brought them into contact with law enforcement and reporting, as well as regulation of these services. And there was a seemingly irresistible pull in this direction. Now, not every feminist supports the carceral state. However, I think it is very hard to accommodate an anti-state logic if you believe that the reason women are oppressed is because men have an intrinsic compulsion to use rape and violence to control them. Sexual harm is analysed as being totally detached from the broader social conditions when it actually stems from them. And more recently, anti-carceral feminists problematise the feminist foundational narrative by saying that the state's violence is itself masculinist or designed to reinforce the economic power of men over women. However, I think this conception blurs the distinction between ordinary men and the state. one is clearly much more powerful than the other here. And I think it really basically misses the point that there is a contradiction between the interests of the mass of working class men and that of the ruling class as a whole, which also includes women. These anti-carceral feminists look towards transformative justice and community accountability as alternatives to dealing with sexual harm towards women within the framework of the carceral state. And however this seems appealing, scholar Mimi Kim acknowledges organisations along these lines are really ephemeral and suffer from what she calls the dilemma of the local. That is, they are small and totally unable to replace the power of the capitalist state to punish. Usually they amount to no more than just a few circles of feminists creating social enterprises which run on hierarchical and pro-capitalist bases. And in 2021, this often gets labelled mutual aid by people like the abolitionist Mariam Carver and is mixed with anarchist theories claiming non-reliance on the state somehow reduces its power. But essentially, these efforts for transformative justice create on an even less consequential level the same problems with the original rape crisis centres, which is that if the point is to immediately help people and ostracise offenders at a community level rather than rely on the state is equipped to carry this out always at a larger scale. So transformative justice is no convincing alternative. Okay. So onto a Marxist alternative to carceral feminism. Mass incarceration and the various ways in which people are oppressed by the coercive sections of the state are all cruel and unjust. The most oppressed in society feel the brunt of this. But why does this occur? So we really need a class understanding of the state rather than just a moral critique. And that's the best way to resist the clouding of issues through the moral panic that feeds the carceral approach. This is also necessary so that we can pose a genuine alternative to the framework of carceral feminism. So Marxists think that the police and prison system are unjust because of the function of these institutions in capitalist society. The state exists to uphold the power of the capitalist class, the minority that own and control the economy, and it does so at the end of the day violently. The problem with relying on the state's carceral logic is not just that it locks people up who should not be treated that way, but because it weakens our power and empowers our class enemies. Most obviously, it empowers our class enemies in a material way. Carceral feminism gives license to a strengthened punitive apparatus, which can be used to discipline the working class in periods of heightened struggle. They have used penal populism to lift the ceiling for punitive sentencing, which tends to flow on into the treatment of other people in the criminal justice system, including those who are trying to challenge the status quo. For example, police patrols at every train station intimidate the oppressed on a daily basis and make it clear that the price of resistance is high. But the effects are also felt politically. The idea that police, right-wing politicians, judges, surveillance technology companies, etc., can all come together with workers as a community to take a stand against sexual violence is a lie. Because we are never in a community with our class enemies. Their interests at the head of an oppressive, exploitative order are always counterposed to those of workers. And this cross-class alliance in the name of women's safety blunts class consciousness and encourages identification with the very people workers should come to fight. It also tends to atomise workers and encourage feelings of powerlessness in the face of malicious threats to their well-being posed by strangers amongst the population. It means that suspicion is placed on others in the class rather than the people who are the very real and constant threat to our well-being, which is the ruling class. Just look at the way that they're handling COVID now. One in 500 people in the US have been killed by the ruling class's ruthless prioritisation of profit over lives. All of these considerations, they become a lot more confused in the context of a penal populist campaign around women's safety, precisely because most ordinary people care about women's rights. But that's precisely the point. The left has to see through the clouds to expose the capitalist interests that these campaigns serve. Our critique of the carceral state does not mean that we demand the legalisation of sex crimes or violence against women. As I've talked about, the fact these are illegal does reflect gains from struggles and development in consciousness around women's rights. However, we do not champion the system that has codified these gains. We recognise that all of these laws and powers are contradictory because they are in the hands of a capitalist state that has an interest in oppressing the working class, warehousing the poor in prisons, and using repressive force to victimise particular racialised groups. Therefore, we do not call for more powers and more repression. Most of what is currently being campaigned for in terms of tougher sentencing and police powers in Western countries does not stem from struggle and does not represent a step forward for working class interest. Instead, it reflects the interests of the state itself and the interests of a distinct layer of establishment feminists who have no reason to feel threatened by the state and recognise it as a repressive force. Another important element of a Marxist critique of the carceral state is that we can't rely on institutions which uphold capitalism to defend the oppressed. Oppression itself stems from capitalism. It exists to reinforce the exploitation of the mass of ordinary people, the working class, which is the source of all capitalist wealth. It keeps the working class politically and socially divided, reducing its power to fight back. Therefore, sexual violence against women is a problem for its harmful effects against women and because it takes our side of the class war backwards by helping reinforce oppressive divisions within the working class. And the more that this layer of establishment feminists succeeds in focusing campaigns around women's rights on demands for more state repression, the harder it is to meaningfully discuss the system that breeds women's oppression or to mobilise supporters of women's rights in a struggle against that system. And the more that these politics can be wielded as part of racist and anti-working class attacks and campaigns. Instead of getting drawn into these campaigns, left-wing people need to lean on the power of ordinary people to collectively fight sexism and capitalist alienation, both of these being the root causes of interpersonal sexual violence, that every working class person of any gender has an interest in participating in, but the state does not. And to return to Black Lives Matter, the main slogan of the Black Lives Matter movement last year, defund the police, runs counter to carceral feminist logic. It says that to make people safer, you have to reduce the number of police. Socialists go even further. We aim for a society without these institutions, one run by the collective authority of the working class. The police and prison system don't play a timeless and essential role for humanity. They are only as old as the class whose power they exist to maintain. So to quickly conclude, this is the reason we want to look at class power as the root of the issue of the carceral state. Opponents of police and prisons should take the perspective of the working class and what increases their power in society, rather than what pragmatically will seem to provide revenge for this or that case of interpersonal violence. And this is the surest way to avoid giving succour to our enemies in the fight for liberation. The domination of the capitalist class is the root of women's oppression too. And workers' power poses an alternative both to the cruelty of the capitalist state and to gender inequality and violence. Our metric has to be what brings us closer to this goal. And carceral feminism is not a step forwards to this goal, but many step backwards. And I'll leave it there.